Glad to have all of you with us for Political Rewind today. I'm Bill Nygut. We have an awful lot to talk about, so I'm going to get right to it. First of all, I'm joined by Kevin Riley, the editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He's with us on most Thursdays, and we're very glad to have Kevin with us today. Kevin, you doing all right?
I sure am. Bill, it's great to be with you, and just trying to get a few technical things sorted out right here as the show goes on. But just like everyone at GPB, we're improvising at the AJC as well.
Yeah, we all are. As a matter of fact, it's when right now we're having a technical issue. Your health and medical reporter, Ariel Hart, is waiting to join us. We're having some problems with the phone line that we want to use to bring her in. So Sam Burmis Dawes, Tom Faust are working right now to try to get Ariel on the line to be part of our phone conversation. In a minute, we're going to talk to two of the leaders at Phoebe Putney Health Systems down in Albany, where they have had one of the real hotspots there in Daugherty County in terms of the coronavirus. And we'll introduce them in just a minute. Before we do, as we like to do every day, I'm going to update you on the numbers in Georgia. And even before I do that, let me say that we've got some big political news that we will be discussing later in the show. Of course, Bernie Sanders has now dropped out of the presidential race, which means that Joe Biden is essentially on path to accept the Democratic nomination. And we will get to that later in the show today, as well as a few other important political stories that are breaking. But as I said, let's take a look at the latest numbers coming from the Department of Public Health, Georgia Department of Public Health. They're now reporting, as of 7 o'clock last night, that we have 10,204 confirmed cases of COVID-19. That's up 1,048 cases in just 24 hours. It's up 2,600 cases in 48 hours. And for the first time, they're reporting that there are confirmed cases of COVID-19 in every one of Georgia's 159 counties. Of course, one of the stories here in Georgia and across the country has been that the virus has spread more widely to rural areas across the country than some had initially believed, given there's more sparse population density. But in fact, more than two-thirds of the country more than two-thirds of the rural areas in the country now report cases of COVID-19. For the first time, we're also seeing figures on a breakdown by race, which has become increasingly important as we're learning that the virus has been particularly pernicious in African-American communities. And we ought to talk about that as we move forward today. Excuse me. Here in Georgia, the starting point ought to be that 63% of the cases, we don't know the racial identity of the people who have the virus. So of those we do know, though, African-Americans represent 21%, whites 15%, and then a very tiny percentage of others. And then finally, we've had 370 deaths in the last 24, that's up 22 in 24 hours, and 77 in the last 48 hours. So a total in Georgia of 370 deaths. All right. All of that said, I do want to turn with your help, Kevin, to the hotspot in Southwest Georgia that we've all been paying an awful lot of attention to. And we're very pleased to be able to welcome two people who have been incredibly busy along with their entire teams down there in dealing with this emergency. Scott Steiner, the CEO of Phoebe Putney Health Systems, and Dr. Stephen Kitchen, the chief medical officer down there. Thank you both for being here. I'm going to sort of say to you guys, I'll throw out as a starting point, and I know Kevin's going to want to jump in, a couple of questions, and I guess I'm going to leave it to you to decide which one of you should answer. But so, well, maybe I do know, Dr. Kitchen, you might be the right person to answer the first one. You've been very transparent, the hospital has, in releasing figures on the cases you're dealing with. Where do you stand today? Are you seeing any flattening of the curve at this point? Are the cases slowing down? Is the need for intensive care bed slowing down? One of you, please address all that for us.
Sure. You know, there's a couple of key measures and statistics that we look at each day. You know, we look at the number of patients coming into all of our facilities with signs and symptoms of COVID-19 who, you know, we commonly refer to as a person under investigation. We look at the number of patients who are admitted to our facilities as well as the number of patients who get transferred out. Needless to say, we quickly, you know, maxed out the capacity of all of our critical care beds, so we were in a position that we could no longer accommodate those patients within our facilities here. So obviously, many, many of our sister hospitals across the state really, really responded to that and have accepted those patients as well. And what I would say is, and I'm always a little reluctant to draw conclusions based on a limited number of data points, but I will tell you, you know, probably over the last 5 days or so, it's been relatively consistent. And so we have seen, we've been able to accommodate most of those patients into our facilities, and the need to transfer patients out, I think, has begun to trend down. Again, you know, I'm a little reluctant to draw conclusions from that, but that's what our observations have been over the last 5 days or so.
I think public health officials across the country are a little reticent when it comes to suggesting that perhaps the spread of the virus is slowing down a bit, but that is what we're hearing out of the task force in Washington. We're beginning to see metrics that suggest that the curves may not be quite as extreme as they initially were thought to be. So a follow-up question, I guess, is, are you, even though it's too early to really have much of a projection on this, does it appear that down in Albany, Daugherty County, which is really ahead of all of us on this, things are, when you say it's become consistent, does that mean you're not seeing as many cases, you're not getting as many positive results, people aren't getting it? What does that exactly mean?
What I would tell you is this, that the number of patients that we admit, if you add the number of patients who are being admitted to our facilities with signs and symptoms of COVID-19, and you add the number of patients we have to transfer out because we don't have capacity, that number has been relatively stable over the last 5 days or so. What we're also finding is that as testing capability increases, you know, the total number of cases, I think, is going to continue to go up, but the number of patients who are requiring admission to the hospital appears at this point to be relatively flat.
So you would say that's very good news, at least right now.
Yes, I think for right now, we feel like our ability to respond to the needs of the community, both in terms of patients who are requiring admission to a general medical floor or to our intensive care unit, seems to be relatively stable.
All right. Kevin, you want to, by the way, we should say, Ariel Hart, we have finally established a phone line with you, and we're going to come to you in just a second. But Kevin, do you want to weigh in here?
Yeah, I guess I'd just love to know from either of you, as this has played out in your community and it has gotten national media attention, do you feel like the message has gone out to other similar communities around the state? And what is your message to those communities?
Hey, Kevin, this is Scott Steiner. I appreciate you and Bill having us on. You know, we've Dr. Kitchen and our team here, one of the things, Bill, you mentioned was the transparency of the information. And we've tried to, from the very beginning, to be very transparent. And we've, with a dashboard, with, you know, what the numbers are, positive, negatives, deaths that we've seen, how many are inpatient, outpatient, putting up a testing center, a phone line. So what we tried to do quickly was to was to not only be transparent, but to do as much as we could. And why we did that is because we wanted others to learn, right? We wanted other communities, especially probably our third day into this, we realized, or we knew we were, this wasn't SARS. This wasn't H1N1. This was something very real and very impactful. And so by doing that, by being transparent with our numbers, by offering to share policies, procedures, we've sent out our masking protocol to more than 100 different organizations to try to give them a jump start, because I think ultimately what we were surprised by was the speed that we went from zero patients to the next day 20, to the next day 40, to the next day 70, and with almost half of those being in the ICU. So what we've seen in other communities, rural, small, urban, even somewhat in Atlanta or Savannah, is the outreach. We've had colleagues call us from all over saying, tell us more. It's not here yet, but we're worried that it can be. Yesterday I did a call on for American College of Healthcare Executives. Over almost 1,000 people were on it to learn about, to hear about our learnings, good or bad. And that's why we've tried to be as transparent with our information as possible, to say we haven't had every answer and we've stumbled, but we've also got a lot of things right. And to Dr. Kitchen's point, where I wouldn't say things have slowed. What I would say is they haven't grown either. But, yesterday we tested more than 200 people, and we're getting back almost 100 positives each and every day. So the virus is very much still in our community, as it is in every community. So, what we're doing with social distancing and I believe is working, and that's the slowing that we're seeing. But it is by no means, in my eyes, and the data doesn't show that the curve has bent over.
Ariel Hart, first of all, welcome to the show. I'm sorry we had a little technical difficulty, but I'd love for you to jump in if you have questions.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me, and good to talk to you again. So those who haven't been following every minute detail of this, do you want to talk a little bit about where the most impact has been for you? And I'm thinking especially about ICU. How has your hospital changed?
Yeah, Ariel, this is Scott, and I certainly welcome Dr. Kitchen's thoughts. But, today we stand with our facilities. We've got 182 positive patients in our three facilities, in Worth County, Sumter County, and here in Daugherty County. 55 of those are in our ICUs, and 44 of those folks are on ventilators. So it's very acute. Here in Albany, we have normally three ICUs, a medical ICU, a cardiac, and a surgical. All three of those are now COVID-only ICUs, and we added another ICU. So we've got four COVID-only ICUs, and they're completely full. So that's, again, this is what's made this disease fairly, or this virus very unique, is the critical nature of it for some segments of our population. As we know, most people will recover at home with mild symptoms and a great percentage without them. But this has, for those, I've been in healthcare for 30 years, I've never seen a virus to create so many critical patients in such a short period of time. And so we do, I can't remember the last day we had an open ICU bed. If as soon as a patient is discharged out of the ICU, another one goes in. So it's
And I'm guessing that your ICU units were not empty beforehand. So you've gone from three that used to house completely other patients to four that only have ICU, that have COVID patients now.
Do you
still have other patients?
Right. Well, we did create a fifth ICU, and in our perioperative area, of course, we've canceled elective surgical procedures, so we have the space. Again, an ICU, the space is important, that you have suction and the oxygen, all those other things, but it's mainly the staff and the doctors that are caring for it. You have the right nurses and doctors. So we created a fifth ICU that will care for other patients that do not have COVID, that are here for trauma, that have a cardiac event. So you add those 10 beds on top of it, and, we're sitting at almost 60 ICU beds, where normally we've got, 30, a little bit more than 30.
Yeah,
38. Yeah.
38.
And what's that like as caregiver? Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'll say this, because I make rounds through our intensive care units every day, and you know, you hear this phrase used a lot, and it might seem trite on one hand, but I will tell you it's absolutely borne out. The response by our staff, the physicians, the ICU nurses, the respiratory therapists, the pharmacist, everyone involved in the care of patients in our critical care units has been nothing short of remarkable. I mean, they have, to say they've risen to the challenge would be an understatement, because they are literally putting themselves in harm's way, operating under extraordinarily challenging conditions, wearing PPE, which is not comfortable, trying to, you know, practice all the right safeguards, but at the same time, the clinical demands of these patients are extreme, and they meet that challenge every day, day in, day out, and you know, there's no question it takes a toll. It takes a physical toll, an emotional toll. But the resilience that they demonstrate day in, day out is certainly inspiring to me. And, you know, I kind of refer to as the sharp end of healthcare and the blunt end. Those people who are providing the care are on the sharp end. I feel like my responsibility as being on the blunt end is to make sure they have the support, the resources, the PPE to be successful in that endeavor day in, day out.
Let me follow up on that, if I might. We hear virtually every day in the national news about the shortage of N95 masks for medical workers, the shortage of other protections, gowns, gloves, the like. Are you well equipped in those areas? Do you have the N95 mask for everyone? Do you yourself, as a private institution, have to go out in the marketplace and compete for PPEs that your staff can wear? Or are you getting help from the state, from the federal government on that? Tell us a little bit about that effort.
Okay. Yeah, Scott, would you like to respond to that?
Yeah, so thanks, Bill. You know, from the very beginning, and that could be a blessing in disguise, is that we were early, is we realized we had to use 6 months of what we of PPE in our first 7 days. So we knew early on that our burn rate, we were using almost 2,500 N95 masks a day. And so we got on it early. And I think, again, that was a blessing in disguise, because while all normal supply chains have dried up and have been, they just haven't had anything for weeks now, we have gone to those secondary markets. We have worked on deals from vendors, from middlemen who we would never normally have done that. We attempted early on, probably it's been more than 2.5 weeks ago, we purchased 500,000, 500,000 N95s. Out of a group out of Mexico. There were 3M masks, and they were $7 each, $3.5 million, something we normally would pay 58 cents for. We felt like we had to do it. We knew if we didn't keep our employees safe, there would be no one to care for our patients. And Dr. Kitchen and our entire team, as he said, on the blunt end, we've been focused on having the supplies that they need to do the job safely. So that deal, unfortunately, when it was getting ready to ship, interesting, it was shipping out of New York, right when New York was seeing a number of cases. And our understanding from the supplier is that shipment was seized by the state of New York, and we didn't get it. But we haven't relied on any one source. We've got 15 irons in the fire as it relates to N95, surgical masks, gowns, isolation equipment. So that has sustained us, and we have not run out. We know every day at any moment of how many, based on our current burn rate, how many days we have left. Luckily today we don't have anything that's under 10 days, but we continue to source it, and almost always in avenues and in sort in companies that we never have done business with before.
Wow. You know, Kevin, that's been, of course, one of the complaints that we've heard over and over again in recent weeks from the federal, in terms of the federal government, that individual hospitals, states, counties are competing for equipment. There doesn't seem to be any process by which the feds, whether it's FEMA or other federal agencies, HHS, are helping locate where protective gear is needed and finding a way to provide at least some for local communities. And Kevin, that's been a real issue all along in this, and to hear about it at Phoebe Putney, and this notion that a supply of masks that was headed for them was confiscated in New York because New York really needed them, really highlights the problem, Kevin.
Yeah, and it's also that problem has turned political because there are those, of course, who want to blame the federal government for not managing this pandemic differently, for being shorthanded in the federal stockpile. Meanwhile, I think the attorney general yesterday in comments said that he felt like it was up to the states. And some people are actually lauding that approach that the states can make their individual decisions. I mean, I don't know what the answer is, except it doesn't seem to put hospitals, especially a smaller system like the one we're talking about here, in a good spot. One of the other controversies I'd like to ask our guests about is around the is it hydroxychloroquine? Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
Chloroquine.
Yeah.
And you know, that we have a story in the paper today about that, and it has just been at the center, and the president is very persistent in talking about that. I want to know if it's been used at your hospital and what your views are on it.
Sure. I'll be glad to comment on that, Bill. And I do have to commend several of the physicians on our staff from the very, very onset. They were really trying to make sure that they were kind of combing the medical literature in terms of what might have a beneficial effect. And so we started using the combination of hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin very, very early in our experience here at Phoebe Putney. And hydroxychloroquine is the kind of the cousin of an old anti-malarial compound that's been around for many, many years. And it is known to have a very advantageous effect in autoimmune diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, that sort of thing. And so it was quickly recognized both in China, France, and other countries that it reduced the period in which viral shedding occurs. So we have been using the combination of those two medications. Basically, we incorporated it into what we call a care pathway. So for patients who are being admitted, whether they're being admitted to a general medical unit or an intensive care unit, they're receiving the combination of those two. Now, the data is evolving all the time, but we think the earlier in the course of disease those two drugs are given and the shorter the period of viral shedding that occurs, it's going to have a more beneficial effect if it's given earlier in the course of disease rather than later in the course of disease.
So let me do this. Let me interrupt. If you two don't mind, I suggested to both of you that we know you're busy and we wanted to let you get back to work. But there are so many questions to ask. We've got to get to a break. Can both of you stay with us for another 10, 15 minutes and continue? I think our listeners would really like to hear more from you. Will that work?
Absolutely.
Sure. That's fine.
Oh, terrific. All right. Ariel Hart, Kevin Riley, We'll be back with you two and with the leaders down at Phoebe Putney Medical Systems in just a moment. You're listening to Political Rewind. Welcome back to Political Rewind. We're joined from Albany at the Phoebe Putney Medical Systems Hospital down there by Dr. Stephen Kitchen. He's the chief medical officer. Scott Steiner, the CEO. They've been very generous with giving us their time when they continue to be very busy. Ariel Hart, health and medical reporter at the AJC, and Kevin Riley are here as well. And Ariel and Kevin, I want to get you back in here pretty quickly, but I do think there's an important question that we need to ask of our two guests, and that is the racial disparities that are beginning to emerge in cases of COVID-19. In the last couple of days, we've seen reporting out of the Washington Post, the New York Times, and I think you're addressing it as we are here in Georgia at the AJC, we're doing it at GPB, that there seems to be a disproportionate share of African Americans with the disease. And we've gotten the first figures out of Georgia, as I reported at the top of the show, that blacks represent about 21% of the cases here, but 63% are unknown, so we have no real sense of all of that. But I want to turn to you, Scott Steiner and Dr. Kitchen, because Daugherty County, I think your African-American population is well over 60%. And I wonder what you can tell us about what you're seeing there in terms of disproportionate disease among African Americans.
Sure. I mean, Bill, I'll again, I'll be glad to comment on that. So, you know, I think what we're seeing manifested right now is really, I think there are two dynamics at play. One, as you've already referenced, if you look at the racial composition of the greater Albany community, it is predominantly African American. So I think that's one factor at play. Unquestionably, I think the other dynamic is what we kind of refer to as the social determinants of health. And what we know for Southwest Georgia is that that poverty in term and the other common social determinants of health are disproportionately going to affect the population that we see that play out in. And unfortunately, disproportionately, that also impacts the African-American community. So I will tell you, and it became very apparent very early that we had patterns of community transmission. And, you know, it got traced back to a couple of African-American funerals that occurred. But what we're also seeing is that significant obesity, hypertension, and some of the other health disparities that disproportionately impact the African American community, unfortunately, are putting them at risk for, I think the proportion of patients that get admitted to the critical care units and become, you know, very, very ill, I think we've seen that play out as well.
Kevin, you want to jump in?
Yeah, you know, one thing I was going to mention and then kind of toss something to Ariel, who has been working pretty hard on this story and tracking some of these statistics. But in Sunday's newspaper, we'll be running a piece from Dr. Lewis Sullivan, the former Secretary of Health and Human Services in Atlanta. And he also cited, you know, some of these same concerns about, of where health is for much of the African-American population in the country. And he also pointed out that, in his view, a higher percentage of African-Americans work in lower paying service jobs like home care, delivery services, and other spots where you just you can't work from home, and where they must interact more with people in order to keep working. But one thing that, Bill, we just have to point out, and I'd like Ariel to talk about this a little bit, is the state is not actually tracking cases by race. We've heard a lot from readers, and I'm sure you've heard from listeners, who want us to publish and share that information, and we're trying to, but unlike other states where the normal collection of this data, that's included as information and helps, I think, people understand what's going on a little bit better, Georgia cannot supply that information as we sit here today. I'm correct about that, right, Ariel?
Well, yeah, wait, let me jump in for a second, and then you please respond, Ariel. Tom Faust, I'm going to need you to give us a sense of where these figures that we reported and the percentage of African Americans come from, if not from the state. I don't want to be giving out information to our listeners if we don't know the source of it and the accuracy of it. So having heard what Kevin just said, I'd love to hear where that information came from. Go ahead, Ariel.
Yeah, well, so it's just been a real struggle, and it's not just Georgia. There are some states that do a good job of tracking that, but it just hasn't been a priority, and you can really see the damage that's done from not having that information. Now, you have to note that state health leaders have taken notice of that problem. They've been asked about it, and they say they're working on it. And Dr. Toomey said in a press conference yesterday, I believe, that they were working on standing up some more information on that. But it's just been such a struggle to actually get that information. And when you look at the stories that have been done in some of the national outlets that really did a great job of kicking off the issue, they have had to reach for places that have that data. And a big help was the mayor of Chicago actually coming out and saying, these are our statistics, and they are not proportionate to the population of this area.
So, by the way, Tom Faust just tells me that the figures that we told you about do come from the Department of Public Health. So perhaps they're beginning to make some effort at getting racial breakdowns out here. The fact that they don't know what 63% of the population looks like, though, tells us that they have a long way to go in getting to the bottom of all that. Ariel, do you have another question for Kevin?
Well, I certainly do. One question I have is, do you as a system know what percent of your COVID patients are African American?
Yeah, so Ariel, this is Scott. So we are working on that information. I think that, you know, to Dr. Kitchen's point, we do know this has affected the African American community in greater numbers than any other. We are in partnership with the state in a lot of different ways. They have provided us supplies. They're working on a surge plan down here. We're very thankful to the governor and Dr. Toomey for that. But I think that the issue with the data, and I'm not here to explain it away, but you've got however many hospitals and health systems, public health agencies, physician offices, because what we report is what Phoebe Putney does. But I can't tell you how many tests and what the information is coming from the private doctor's offices or from the local FQHC or from an urgent care center or from a surgery center. So everybody's got their own IT systems. Every hospital has a different system. Maybe it's Epic or Cerner or Meditech. So I think it's how do you consolidate all that information, just to even say how many positives, how many negatives, and how many deaths, and then how do you get into it? What's the age? What's the race? What's the sex? Where do they live? How do we heat map this? So I think it's quite complicated. It shouldn't be, and I think that's a learning for us, is that information has to be ready at moment's notice. And I know that's been one of our struggles, is to just get our hands around the data, because there's so much of it. That it's how do you report it out in a way that people can understand and it's digestible.
And if there's one more thing that you wanted to say to leaders or the public, we talk a lot about the PPE that everyone is running short of. Is there anything else that you are concerned about that you need? I'm wondering about staff. I'm wondering about the drugs that it takes to intubate people. Anything else that you would want to put out there?
Yeah, that's right. You just touched on probably the three biggest ones we're talking about today is access to faster testing. Too much of the testing is still taking 4, 5, 6, 7, sometimes 10 days. So we're trying to access the quicker testing. The pharmaceuticals, this disease and what we're doing is like squeezing the balloon. Just when you think you've got one thing figured out, boom, guess what there's a shortage of? It's fentanyl. And what do you use fentanyl for? You use it to intubate patients to be able to do that from a physiology standpoint. And then staffing. You know, we've had that partnership with the state. They've helped us with getting some urgent staffing in, critical care nurses, physicians, others. But we have also seen some of our nurses that were not necessarily from our area, but who were agency nurses that we had contracted with, leaving and going to other cities where they're getting offers of 2 or 3 times the amount of pay that is available for them in their current contract. So, you know, this competition is not only just in supplies, it's now for that vital healthcare worker.
It's like a
It's interesting, Kevin Riley, that you all had a story on the front page of the paper today saying that there were talking about a Southwest Airlines flight, a photograph of medical personnel from the Atlanta area, all flying up to New York to work in hospitals, healthcare centers there, medical centers there, because they were going to, they wanted to work and help, but they were also getting a much bigger paycheck. We are on the verge of having to take another break. Before we do, thank Scott Steiner and Stephen Kitchen for being with us. Kevin, I'll give you a chance for one last question.
Well, I should be clarified too, Bill, my comment about the statistics regarding race, that those numbers became available from the state, I think, either early today or late yesterday. That was the first time that they were available. So for your listeners, just to be clear, to this point, we hadn't seen them, and I don't think we've been able – our folks, at least, have been able to ask a lot of questions about how they've been compiled. I'm interested, Scott. I mean, from the point of view of all the media attention that you've got, I mean, we've seen stories, you know, after we came down and really did a thorough look at how things were going at the hospital in Albany, then you heard from, I think, just about all the big ones, New York Times, Washington Post. What has that been like for you to suddenly become, in some ways, the epicenter of Georgia coverage?
Yeah, it's something we never envisioned. It's a contest we never wanted to win. We never even wanted to be in. But you know what we recognized from the beginning, whether it was when we were looking at our mask shortage, and we were having people sew masks, is how could we get this story out because of the urgency, because of the need to protect our people. And so that's been our intent, is to tell the story of shortages, because what we don't want is small urban or rural America to be forgotten. We understand the importance of New York and Los Angeles and the big cities. We're not saying, gee, give it to us instead of them. But what we were adamant about was we take seriously caring for our communities at all times. And in the time of a pandemic, who do they look to? And it's us. And we take pride in that. And so we're making sure we bang that drum, that to say, hey, we need those same supplies. We need those same medications. We need those same experts. And because the people that we have, I've been calling them, they're warriors. They run into the fight. They run into the fire every time, to Dr. Kitchen's point. They strap on that PPE that is so terribly uncomfortable to do, and they go in and they do it every day because they love our community, and it's their calling in life. And so that's been what I've been trying to focus on, is telling their story, telling the story of our patients and our community. And nothing that I ever thought I would do. But hopefully by doing it, we've been able to bring resources maybe we wouldn't have had before, and attention and celebration. And we've seen that across the country, and we've got an incredible community here who has rallied around the hospital, around our first responders. And it's so much the silver lining in all this, and I want to make sure it's told.
Well, Scott Steiner and Dr. Stephen Kitchen, we really appreciate your being with us on Political Rewind today, and we send you our best thoughts and hopes for your ability to continue dealing in the most positive way possible with the pandemic in Southwest Georgia. Thanks so very much for joining us. Let's do this. Let's take a brief break, and we'll be back with more on Political Rewind. We're back on Political Rewind. Ariel Hart, Kevin Riley of the AJC are with me. Before we turn a little more specifically to politics, Tom Faust has figures that have been reported by the Daugherty County Coroner, Michael Fowler, that do give us some insights about racial breakdowns, important data. There have been 63 deaths in Daugherty County. 23, according to the coroner, were black males. 23 were black females, 11 white females, 6 white males. It tells you about the preponderance of African Americans who have gotten the disease, although, again, Daugherty County is a largely majority black community. So it would be understandable if there are more blacks who have contracted the virus, but we also know about the disparities in healthcare. All right, let's do this. Ariel and Kevin, let's move on and talk a little bit about politics. Kevin, I want to turn to you first. We know that Bernie Sanders yesterday finally decided it was time to drop out of the Democratic presidential race. Let's listen to how he described his decision, and then we'll talk about it.
But as I see the crisis gripping the nation, exacerbated by a president unwilling or unable to provide any kind of credible leadership, and the work that needs to be done to protect people in this most desperate hour, I cannot in good conscience continue to mount a campaign that cannot win and which would interfere with the important work required of all of us in this difficult hour.
So, Kevin, Joe Biden becomes the presumptive nominee of the Democratic Party. And what's interesting, of course, is we already know that our primary contest here in terms of the presidential race is going to be much less meaningful than at one point it might have been. Now, the big question, it'll be interesting to see whether voters turn out at all, whether it's by absentee ballot or in person, to vote for Joe Biden. We'll get some sense of how much energy he can build here to get a big turnout in his behalf.
Right. I do think that's a big question, Bill, particularly in Georgia, but also the Democrats had a presumptive nominee really early on last time, and we know what happened there. I also thought it was interesting listening to Bernie Sanders, who did not endorse Biden in his statement from what I understand and have read. And then second,
no, he didn't. You're right.
He will remain on ballots as this goes forward. And was clear, he expects to exert a lot of influence on whatever the Democratic platform turns out to be. So I think those who believe he should keep disrupting may be heartened by that. And those who believe he's had his day and he should quiet down and help the Democrats figure out how to beat President Trump might be a little worried.
You know, Ariel, I want to bring you into this conversation because we know that his showcase issue, Bernie Sanders' showcase issue, of course, has been Medicare for all. And so there's two aspects of that that are kind of interesting to talk about right now. Number one, since the pandemic struck, Bernie Sanders, before dropping out of the race, was saying to people, Medicare for all is more important than ever. Kind of told you so. Now we see why we need a national healthcare system. But also of importance is the fact that when Joe Biden yesterday thanked Bernie Sanders for his participation in the race, said he had a lot of great ideas that he himself would embrace. He specifically was not going to embrace Medicare for all. But give us your thoughts on whether national health care suddenly becomes a much more prominent issue in the presidential race this fall.
I think health care is going to be a much more prominent issue. You know, there's always going to be a constituency that was raised by Bernie and by Elizabeth Warren for national health care. But you just don't have the two leading candidates who have any interest in making that happen now. But I think what you may have is that Biden did kind of tip his hat to the policies that Sanders had advocated for. And so he may have kind of moved the conversation a little bit leftward. We'll have to wait and see.
Did we lose you? I think maybe
no,
we
I
lost.
Was,
are you there?
Yeah, I just kind of feel like the answer to the question is that, you know, that there seems to be little chance at this point that Medicare for all is going to be some kind of a big push from any of the candidates left. But at least you will, I think, have a nod to the voters who would have advocated for that, and you'll have some kind of bigger push for broad health care coverage, whatever form that ends up taking.
Yeah, but we shouldn't forget, of course, that there is still a lawsuit filed by attorneys general in any number of states, including here, Chris Carr, that's making its way through the courts, that would overturn the Affordable Care Act entirely, even as a presidential race will be make health care one of the top issues. Right, Ariel?
Yeah, and Democrats are pushing that as much as they can. They're trying to raise that issue and keep it in the news at every possible turn. It's going to get taken up by the court, and you could see in the wake of this pandemic a massive overturning of the healthcare system that we've come to know over the last 10 years.
Kevin, let me bring you in on another question that really is political in nature. We had a conversation about this on the show yesterday, but given that you're the editor of a major daily newspaper, it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on this. We know that President Trump has chosen to make the daily coronavirus briefing kind of a showcase for his thoughts, his ideas, giving reports on updates of what's happening out there. And there's been some criticism that electronic news organizations, cable news networks, for instance, are giving him a forum that allows him to give out misinformation, contradict himself repeatedly. And there's been a concern that perhaps he shouldn't be getting all of this airtime. Some people would suggest it reminds them of 2016 when the cable networks covered his rallies start to finish night after night because they thought they were such high entertainment. As the editor of a major newspaper, how do you look at that?
Well, I can tell you this. I'm glad that I'm not running a network and trying to figure out what to do there, because we at least can step back and really report the accuracy of his statements in a way that wise people can, I think, reach their own conclusions about what's going on. But I think it's a hard thing, because during a time like this, I think the nation wants to hear from the president. And I think a lot of people are getting their information that way. But without question, he contradicts himself if you watch those things, he will say one thing and then deny he said it, and he will change his mind, and he will say something that was different from the day before. You have to hope that wise people can make their own decisions about what's going on there. And it, as you know, his approval rating in the end sort of stays at that 35 to 45% range, no matter what happens.
Kevin, I'm going to interrupt because we are running out of time. You get the last word in today's show. So, Kevin Riley, Ariel Hart, thank you so much for joining us. It was great to have Dr. Stephen Kitchens and Scott Steiner from Phoebe Putney in Southwest Georgia on the show today as well. We're back tomorrow with the show. We're going to take a look at the hospitality industry and restaurant workers and how they've been affected by coronavirus. We'll do all that and more on our next Political Rewind. See you tomorrow.